Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
WBUR. From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Coming up this hour, we'll talk about democracy foundering and failing in Zimbabwe. But first, we begin with unfolding developments in the Middle East, where the last 24 hours have brought more twists and turns. Earlier today, Prime Minister Sharon told Israeli TV that conditions were still not ripe for Yasser Arafat to travel to Beirut. Hours later, Chairman Arafat said he had decided not to attend the Arab League summit. Minutes ago, I spoke with Saud Abu Ramadan, a reporter with UPI in Gaza, and asked him about today's announcements.
The Palestinian Authority officials, including Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, had been hinting all the last couple of days that if Sharon is going to impose impossible conditions and put obstacles for Arafat going to Beirut and attend the Arab summit, Arafat won't go. So the decision that had been made tonight from Ramallah said that Arafat and the Palestinian leadership had decided that Arafat won't go to Beirut, and this is final. Just, you know, as they say, to block any Israeli attempt to impose their own conditions or pressure on the Palestinians. Now, the two conditions Sharon has been calling for is, first, the United States must grant Israel that if any terrorist attack or violent attack would be carried out against Israel while Arafat is away, Israel would have the right not to let him return back. And the second condition is that the Arafat had to address a speech in Arabic to the Palestinian people in the West Bank and Gaza, announcing a ceasefire. So those two conditions were not accepted by the Palestinians and considered them as a humiliation for Arafat and the Palestinian leadership. This is why they had decided not to go.
Hosni Mubarak, Egyptian's president, and Arafat will both now not be at the summit, the Arab Leaders Summit in Beirut. What are the expectations of that summit at this point? Is there still hope that the Saudi peace initiative will move ahead, or is it losing steam because of these no-shows?
Well, it's not only Mubarak and Arafat are not going to attend the summit. There are about nine Arab leaders, including Muammar Gaddafi from Libya and the Qatari prince, and other Arab leaders are not going to attend the Arab summit, which means that the content of the Arab summit and all issues are going to be discussed on Wednesday and Thursday are going to be meaningless. First, the Palestinian people in Gaza and the West Bank are very pessimistic from, you know, any decision that would be issued by the Arab summit at the final meeting. And also, they are pessimistic of the nearest future. They believe that Ariel Sharon and the Israeli government are planning for a wide military action to be carried against the Palestinian territories, and they believe that the Arabs are not going to do anything in order to help them. This is on one hand. On the other hand, the Palestinian leadership, including Arafat, and the Palestinian people, including militant factions, are seeing that the United States is not playing an important role in pushing forward both sides, Israel and the Palestinians, in bringing them back to the negotiation table and to the resumption of the peace process. Now, in general, the Palestinians believe that the Arab summit is not going to be very important for them, because the Palestinians believe that the Arabs are not going to do anything in ending the Israeli military actions against the Palestinian territories.
So it sounds as though you're saying that the hope of a breakthrough, or at least a fresh start coming out of the Saudi initiative, is lost before the Arab summit really even begins.
That's true. As I said before, that there are about nine Arab leaders, including Arafat and Hosni Mubarak, are not going to be there. So voting for accepting the Saudi Arabian initiative would be meaningless, since Arafat, who is part of the conflict with Israel, is not there, despite of Arafat's decision that he is going to address the Arab summit with a speech on the satellite from Ramallah.
And two UN observers died today.
That's right. Now, there are arguments between both sides. Israel had announced that Palestinian militants shot at the international observer's car north of Hebron in southern West Bank, while a Palestinian Authority official spokesman, had said that Israeli troops are stationed in two Palestinian buildings. You know, Israeli troops usually occupy the roofs of several buildings into area classified as Area A, into the Palestinian territories. And the spokesman says that the soldiers on the roofs of those buildings opened fire at the international observer's car, killed two, one Turkish, one Swiss, and injured a third Turkish person.
Saud Abu Ramadan is a reporter with UPI. He spoke to us from Gaza. It seems so long ago now, 20 years ago anyway, in the early 1980s, Zimbabwe embodied the hopes and dreams of a new era for Africa. It was held up by the West as the model of a country transitioning out of colonial power and into true democratic rule. Zimbabwe's independence leader and elected president, Robert Mugabe, was hailed as a political visionary, ready to take his country out of white minority rule and into a new age of freedom and prosperity. His early presidency was marked with economic and social development. Tourism flourished, schools multiplied. Now, 22 years later, the country is foundering. There's not enough food. The economy is collapsing. HIV and AIDS are rampant. And Robert Mugabe, once the idealist, is now called a brutal autocrat, condemned by the United States and the West for a reign of terror and corruption. By most accounts, the elections this month in Zimbabwe were a sham. But so it seems, too often is democracy and development in much of Africa today. As the continent struggles with overwhelming poverty and disease, African regimes and the world's rich nations are struggling over the right way to govern and to grow. Is Western-style democracy appropriate for Africa? What will it take to bring effective government to Africa? And what is fair for the world, the West, to ask in return for vitally needed aid? What is the way forward in Africa? You can join the conversation this evening at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight from London is Martin Meredith. He's been foreign correspondent in Africa for the London Observer and Sunday Times. His latest book is Our Votes, Our Guns, Robert Mugabe and the Tragedy of Zimbabwe. Good evening and welcome, Martin Meredith.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us from Vermont Public Radio is our On Point news analyst, Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Martin Meredith, it has not been a pretty picture coming out of Zimbabwe in the last couple of months as the world watched closely. You've been watching closely for a long, long time. We want to look at development, democracy, the way forward in Africa tonight. What can we learn from what we've just seen in Zimbabwe about Africa's view, or at least some African leaders' view, of the best way ahead?
Well, there are two perspectives on Zimbabwe as far as the election is concerned. One is that it was obtained by violence, intimidation, fraud, electoral rigging, every kind of misdemeanor and trick that Mugabe could devise to win the election. The other aspect of the election is actually much more encouraging, is that despite all the violence and intimidation, there were Zimbabweans in their hundreds of thousands who were determined to stand up for democracy and to make their voices heard and to vote for whom they wanted to vote. Now, I actually find that extraordinarily encouraging. The climate of fear that was apparent during the voting did not intimidate all these people who came out and voted for the opposition, despite the risks of harassment and reprisals that there were.
So God bless the urge of the people to come out and vote, and yet at the same time, you know all the numbers about the even starvation in Zimbabwe now, the shortages, the lack of political freedom, the charges of treason brought against opposition leaders. We can only applaud people for coming out, but they don't seem to be getting what they deserve in return, or do they?
No, they're certainly not, in that there's no way that Mugabe can claim to be a legitimate leader. He stole the election. And the tragedy is that, as you mentioned, Zimbabwe is in a state of severe economic decline. It's bankrupt. It has no foreign exchange. It is, as you say, short of food. And yet, because of the way in which Mugabe stole the election, there is going to be no rescue package put together by, if you like, Western helpers, because everybody in the West disapproves of the way that Mugabe stole the election.
We're going to get down to the nub of that standoff between the West and, in this case, Zimbabwe, and in other cases, other countries in Africa. But take us back, Martin Meredith, and give us the short course on how Zimbabwe went from being a place of abundant agricultural production and beautiful climate and high hopes in the 80s to the shambles that it's in today.
Well, it's quite true that at the time of independence in 1980, the prospects of Zimbabwe were very good indeed, that Mugabe had won an election quite legitimately, although there was a certain amount of violence which accompanied it.
Even then.
He was, as you mentioned in your introduction, the darling of the West. Western aid poured in. There were nearly kind of $2 billion worth of aid promised within the first year. Mugabe embarked on effective programs on education and health. But what happened in the kind of looking at in a short way is that eventually corruption took root. There was economic mismanagement, and Mugabe's popularity fell into decline. Along the way, he also unleashed a campaign of military repression against opposition in Matabele land, the western part of Zimbabwe, in the 1980s.
Against his opponent, Nkomo.
That's right. And in that campaign of repression, at least 10,000 civilians died. Mugabe was the author of this terror which was brought to Matabele land, and it was an example of the ruthlessness with which he was prepared to act against political opposition. However, for 20 years or so, everything more or less went on an even keel, although into a kind of steady decline and economic difficulties and the spreading blight of corruption. But what suddenly changed the whole perspective was the way in 2 years ago Mugabe decided to hold a referendum asking for even more power than he had. He had virtually dictatorial powers and he was prepared to use them, but he still wanted more. To his shock and amazement, the electorate turned round and said no. For the first time, Mugabe therefore caught a glimpse of the way in which his grip on power was slipping. And for the last 2 years, he's resorted to violence, intimidation, lawlessness of every kind in a bid basically to retain power. And that was the same methods that he was using during the election campaign.
Martin Meredith, we're going to look at this from a lot of angles tonight. I want to bring my colleague Jack Beatty into the conversation. Jack, here we are at the very moment that the West is realizing, my God, we have to do something about Africa. And then here comes an example like Zimbabwe, where you've got Mugabe standing across the road, certainly refusing to play by international norms and leaving his people suffering. How do we link aid and expectations in Africa?
Well, that seems to be the new line on aid. President Bush at the Monterey conference spoke of the prerequisite of good government to aid. And that question hasn't been much asked. That hasn't really been a premise of U.S. Aid policy in the past. Our philosophy was perhaps best given by Franklin Roosevelt when someone said to him that Somoza of Nicaragua was an SOB. He said, yes, but he's our SOB. Mm-hmm. And we have given aid to SOB after SOB around the world, caring nothing about the governance, including Mugabe in the early days. So a change in the aid formula, whereby these dictators really are faced with it, they either abide by the rule of law or they lose some of their loot. I think this is actually well timed, and that Zimbabwe is a kind of text of what can happen when when basic protections go by the board.
Zimbabwe, Africa, and the West are all reaping a whirlwind here. There was, of course, a long colonial period, and then there was the Cold War with lots of dirty deals struck. We're asking, can the world afford an undeveloped, undemocratic Africa? Can Africa achieve economic development without democracy? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston,
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about development and democracy in Africa. We're starting with Zimbabwe tonight. It's got the big developments in the last month where a disputed election went back to Robert Mugabe, and his opponent is now charged with treason. Can the world afford an undeveloped, undemocratic Africa? And can Africa achieve economic development without democracy? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We are joined by from London by Martin Meredith, author of the new book, Our Votes, Our Guns, Robert Mugabe and the Tragedy of Zimbabwe. Martin Meredith, put this in context for us. There's plenty of blame to go around here, and I think people are often confused. We ultimately want to look ahead, but we also want to understand history here. What portions of Zimbabwe's miseries do you pin on colonial exploitation, on Cold War manipulation, and on the abusive leadership of its own African leader?
Well, I think a lot of the blame actually descends on the white rulers of Rhodesia in the 1960s and the 1970s. They basically believed in white supremacy to the extent that they precipitated a guerrilla war against white rule. And in a sense, Mugabe was the victor eventually of that war, but it created a huge amount of kind of problems, entirely unnecessary, and it plunged Zimbabwe into a civil war for 7 years, in which at least 30,000 people lost their lives and caused a great deal of ill feeling and dissension among the races in Rhodesia, as Zimbabwe was then called.
And the Cold War manipulation that Jack Beatty was referring to, how keenly was that felt in Zimbabwe, and how large a factor do you see that as having been across Africa?
Well, the Cold War had a huge impact all the way across Africa. But in terms of Zimbabwe, the government used to portray the war as being, if you like, on the one hand, Western civilization being attacked by communist-inspired terrorists and so on. It was never really like that at all. It was basically a government wedded to white supremacy, which was being attacked by guerrilla movements attempting to gain majority rule. And because of the obstinacy of the white rulers, and Ian Smith, the white leader of Rhodesia at the time, there was no other way in which they could have achieved majority rule other than by violence. The problem from then on was just that Mugabe, in a sense, has never really allowed violence a back seat, that he's used it. It's become his stock in trade.
Well, take us to that current point, because I think many Westerners or the world is often stymied by this sense, well, we helped create this problem, so maybe we can't complain about it. But now, out of humanity, if nothing else, when you look at the suffering in Africa, something has to be done, and we want to do something about it. So at this point, do we still look back to the colonial history and say, well, it's our fault, they should govern however they like now? Or should people be intervening more aggressively, for example, in Zimbabwe's case?
Well, and I think that it is actually an interesting turning point. And Zimbabwe, perhaps, is almost a test case that as long as the West uses its wealth and its influence to good effect, and that was never really going on during the Cold War, because as John Beatty said, if he's our SOB, that's all that really counted. But if now the West starts using its wealth and influence to good effect, then there is a chance that Africa can actually turn around. The problem is that there are a lot of declarations being made by African leaders about their recognition of the need for good governance and human rights. Such declarations have been made constantly for years and years. Mugabe himself signed up to what was called the Harare Declaration, which committed him supposedly to good governance. It was meaningless. However, there is now such desperate need in Africa for foreign assistance that it is possible to use the leverage which comes from the need for Western assistance to ensure that democracy and human respect for human rights and the law is adhered to more rigorously than it has been done in the past.
That is
now, because Africa is, if you like, desperate for what it calls its Marshall Plan, its $45 billion worth of aid, and the West is in an influential enough position to say, well, we will assist you providing there is actual practice, not just declarations of good intent, but real practice in terms of adhering to democracy and human rights, that something good might well come out of it.
And yet these most recent elections in Zimbabwe would they indicate that leverage is far from complete leverage. Martin Meredith, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation now Tom MacDonald. He was U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe from 1997 to 2001 during the second Clinton administration. He's now a managing partner in the Washington, D.C. law firm of Arder & Haddon. Good evening and welcome, Ambassador Tom MacDonald.
Tom, nice to be with you all.
Great to have you. Ambassador, we've been talking about development, about democracy and good governance, about the future of Africa at a point where its problems are so acute, but yet nobody wants to throw money at rulers like Robert Mugabe, who seem to have led his country into a very bad situation indeed. You heard just now Martin Meredith describing what he sees as a potential for convergence between expectations of better government and African governments because they need aid complying. On the other hand, in the aftermath of the Mugabe re-election, the disputed re-election, we see African leaders complimenting and celebrating this victory while the West has largely stood up and said this is not a good show. Do you really see a convergence, a new understanding or agreement over the kind of government and governance needed in Africa between African leaders and the West?
Oh, I think so. And that clearly guided us in the Clinton administration. I know the Bush folks are continuing that notion that support money is not going to be provided if we're not supporting basic human rights, if there's not macroeconomic reforms, if people are not moving in the right direction.
But isn't Zimbabwe a standing refute to that view?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it certainly is a place where, and that's what I was getting to, there are some, like President Mugabe and his government, who will go it alone. They don't want our help. They don't need our help. And they are the consummate survivors. But, Tom, I would suggest to you that we need to pick our spots. I mean, there are brighter places, the Senegals, the Ghanas, some of the other places, the Mozambiques, where there have been elections. Changes have come about, obviously, South Africa in that same category. So we can't throw them all in the same lot. But in the case of Zimbabwe, it's clearly a tragedy with the fraud and the illegality around this recent election. But you have a survivor, a head of state who really seems unaffected by what pressure comes. And so in some of these countries, the message of good governance and protecting human rights will play, and it will lead us to being partners together. And in other places, it's a dead end.
And when you say we, I guess that means the developed world has to pick its spots. That we need to go lean toward the brighter examples in Africa.
There are 50-some countries in Africa.
Does that constitute a majority?
There's not enough money in the world to sort of deal with all of them. I mean, they're obviously important, but I think there are countries that are more important, candidly, in the interests of the United States and its Western allies, and certainly Zimbabwe is one. And so the pressure will be brought to bear greater. But there are other places where economic development can go on, where trade investment does go on and can go on.
Listeners, we're talking about Africa, about development and democracy, good governance, and what it all means tonight. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What is the world's, the West's responsibility now in Africa, and why has Africa had such a hard time? You can join the conversation. Bernard is on the line. Welcome, Bernard. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Well, I am African myself. I'm from Kenya.
Welcome.
Thank you. This is my point. See, when I listen to people in the United States, all in government, they talk about U.S. interest.
Mm-hmm.
See, U.S. interest comes at a certain expense to other people.
Mm-hmm.
So all the leaders in Africa have been supported very much by the United States. I mean, President Moi in Kenya is an example.
Mm-hmm. Daniel Arap Moi.
Right. He's received a lot of support from the United States over the years. I mean, Mobutu is another example. All these leaders don't help their people at all.
So are you saying, as an African, that you see the West, or the United States in particular, as an anti-democratic force in Africa?
No, that's not exactly what I'm saying.
All
what
right.
I'm saying is they should stop supporting this kind of dictators one way or the other. If they would stop supporting this kind of dictators, there would be some kind of change in Africa in its own way.
Well, I think there are examples. I mean, clearly during the Cold War period, we were supporting a number of the bad guys, and there's been apologies all around. More recently, certainly in the case of Nigeria with General Abacha, he was isolated. That was a pariah state. We now have General Obasanjo, who was elected and will presumably seek re-election down the line. So the caller is right. I mean, there is this checkered history, but I think we are now trying to address Africa, you know, on an equal footing. What are you going to bring to the table? What are we going to bring to the table? How can we work together? We are willing to partner with you, but these are some requirements. And Tom, we talk about democracy, and I would suggest it really is about good governance. I mean, when you're in a place like Zimbabwe, where I was for 3 years, people want the trash picked up. They want services. They want accountable government. They don't want corruption. They may not exactly want the American model for democracy, but one shoe size doesn't fit all, and we ought to be flexible as we go forward.
Well, there's a couple of interesting questions here. Martin Meredith, let me put one to you. What about this democracy versus good government? Can we have good government in Africa without democracy?
I think the record is pretty grim. That is that for a period of 20 years or so, Africa had a series of one-party states which were nothing really much more than dictatorships, even if some of them were relatively benign. And the record during that 20-year period of one-party rule, in economic terms, was abysmal. That is, dictatorships on the whole do not provide economic growth and good government. It usually leads kind of to corruption. So although, as the ambassador was saying, it is, if you like, in terms of preferences, it's better to have good governance above all else, and not necessarily worry too much as to whether it's democratic or not. But I think that there are very, very few examples that Africa has ever shown of where you have good governance as a result of, if you like, autocratic rule. It just doesn't seem to occur that way. Hmm. Therefore, I would link strongly, as it were, the idea of democracy to good governance. That is, if you do have regular elections, as indeed the rest of the world, much of the rest of the world has, you actually provide a much more stable and accountable government. There is much more transparency. There has to be. Essentially, what you get in Africa, in African dictatorships, and your Kenyan caller was as an example of that, of the way that Daniel Arap Moi's government in Kenya is basically corrupt and not accountable, and is in that category of states which are a living example of how that provides bad governance and a poor economic record.
And yet has been much more than tolerated by the West for many, many years.
Well, it was, if you like, better in earlier years in terms of good governance than it is now. But there is this sea change in attitude in the West. Is that the West no longer sees, and applies to the United States and to Europe too, the West no longer sees the need to pick dictators or placemen merely because they support the West or support particular interests either of the United States or indeed of European government.
I want to turn to the phones. Fadiki is on the line. Fadiki, welcome. You're on the air.
Yes, how are you this evening?
We're very well, thanks.
Yes, what I've come up, I'm finding a lot of irony in this discussion when I hear about the West and its criticism of Mugabe and Mugabe the dictator. And what I'm thinking is that in the 1800s, Europe and this country, you know, they carved up Africa through violence.
Absolutely.
And plundered it and became wealthy through it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm seeing right now is there was colonization through violence, and what I'm seeing right now is that the West and the United States are trying to recolonize through diplomacy. And when I say that is that there's no desire for stabilization in Africa because of the fact that in terms of the natural resources there, the West and the United States, they realize the fact that the future of the world depends on the resources there in Africa.
So you think it's still about exploitation, not about any true caring for
exactly.
the people of Africa?
When I'm hearing this conversation, I'm saying, wait a minute. As I heard the general saying, this was Rhodesia, Ian Smith, apartheid now, apartheid forever.
Mm-hmm.
The African majority having none of the wealth. And one of the issues there right now is that the white minority still controls the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's going on is that this land issue is something wherein the people are saying, wait a minute. You know, this land was stolen from us, and the folks who stole it still have it, and we're supposed to have independence, and we're still in poverty. So,
Farki, we hear your point. Let me turn it to our guest. And I want to go first to Jack Beattie. Jack, how do we wrestle with this issue of the long legacy of exploitation, the continuing suspicion, you hear it right here in Farki's voice, that exploitation is still the subtext, and yet here's a continent full of people that need our simple human help.
We operate under a heavy burden, one that we picked up voluntarily, unlike the colonial powers did too, but we picked it up a century later in the Cold War. Reaction to what Fatiki was saying is that, well, yes, but surely he doesn't want repression of Africans by governments such as Mugabe's. He doesn't want political violence. I mean, in other words, I don't see the hand of the West involved in some fell way in the election in Zimbabwe. What I see is the hand of Robert Mugabe suppressing what could have been an orderly transfer of power to the detriment of his own people. Leave out the West.
Mm. Fadiki, thanks for your call. But to also Ambassador Tom McDonald, to Fadiki's point about the land redistribution violently exercised now or recently going on, do you see this as a legitimate redistribution of resources for the benefit of Zimbabwe's people? Or we've been told on this show that this is also a kind of political exploitation?
Well, let me just first comment on the question of good governance. Part of my point assumes democracy. It doesn't have to be the exact model of the United States, but clearly elections and the kinds of freedom. So that's subsumed in the comment about good governance that was made a few moments ago. On the question of the land, listen, we went out to places where folks showed us our grandparents had been moved off this land at gunpoint. There clearly is a moral imperative in Zimbabwe to solve the land question. I spent hundreds of hours and the staff out there. There was a land conference in 1998 where the donors stepped up and said, we will work with you on this. But
so you agree with Mugabe it's time to move the white farmers off?
I'm sorry?
Are you saying you agree with Mugabe that it's time to move?
No. If you let me finish, the point is they then made this a political issue. This clearly is a political tool. This is Mugabe and his party using this as a lever to hold on to power. There's nothing left in the cupboard. The party used to give grain out to people. There used to be a largesse. It's been spent. What's left is land. And we had said, the UN, Secretary General, all sorts of eminent persons, if you want to solve the land problem, it can be solved. If you want to use it as a political tool, then we should expose it for what it is. And that's what's been done.
It's been a political tool lately. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking about Zimbabwe, Africa, democracy, development. Something's got to be done. How do we accomplish it? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at development and democracy in Africa through the prism of Zimbabwe this evening. What can we learn from Zimbabwe's experience? Can the United States, with its own hanging chads, throw stones? And is the Bush administration right to ask for better government before more aid flows? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Martin Meredith. He's author of Our Votes, Our Guns, Robert Mugabe and the Tragedy of Zimbabwe. And by Ambassador Tom McDonald. He was U.S. Ambassador to Zimbabwe from 1997 to 2001. And by a lot of you, Corey is on the line. Welcome, Corey. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Tom. I really love the show.
Great.
My comment is, I can't get over how the whole question of what is good for Africa focuses around economic development, and it seems like you know, economic development is a criteria by which we're judging whether or not Africa is being successful or not.
But Corey, people are starving.
Right. And you know, that obviously that needs to be addressed. But
Can I comment here?
Is this Ambassador McDonald?
Yes.
Please.
Yeah. Let me speak to that. Zimbabwe has the highest literacy rate in Africa, 90%. There are no jobs, though. And so when we talk about the underlying social problems, I mean, the AIDS, this thing is rotting away underneath. People need employment and jobs at the end of the day to survive and to take care of their families and pay their school fees. So, you know, we need to get past the sort of high-minded policies and sort of say, well, what does this mean to the person on the ground? So, yes, this ought not to just be a dollars and cents discussion, but to put it in context, one of the things we promoted out there was tourism development, not only in Zimbabwe, but in the region, because it's job creation and hard currency to those economies that so desperately need it. So if you provide employment, if you provide an opportunity, a future, you then encourage democratic development and good governance, and people can take care of themselves, and it would obviously eradicate poverty.
I guess when we say development and economic development, it's really it's a word that stands for food, it stands for education, it stands for fundamental human health, doesn't it, Martin Meredith?
It certainly does. I mean, the focus really has to be on economic development, which does mean all those things. You can't provide education or health or transport or any other kind of government service without economic development. It's the basis on which most modern states function, and that applies in Africa just as much as it does in the United States or Europe.
Sulia is calling from Edinburgh, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Sulia.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, good evening.
Hi, I have two questions, and my first question goes to the ambassador. I want to know whether the U.S. government is particularly interested in helping Zimbabwe, or the requirement of helping Zimbabwe is to have a good government. I'm saying that primarily because most of the Zimbabweans aren't educated, and once you get those guys, you know, you give them the chance to vote, and people, uneducated people, don't know what they want. That's bad for Zimbabwe. And the second question, I think, in between the U.S.-European relationship and Africa, there is a conflict of interest. They always want to tell us what to do. If you want to help us, help us. Don't tell us what to do. We have different culture, different everything, and I think we have the right to decide who our leader want to be and keep going with that.
Well, Sulia, you bring it right down to the focus that we want to look at tonight, and I will put it to Ambassador Tom McDonald first. What about this issue? Given the failings we've seen, for example, in Zimbabwe's government in recent years, and by these failings we don't mean by some high-concept Western standard, but simply in terms, if you like, of the standard of living, the ability to put food on the table that Zimbabweans face, is the West, is the United States justified in asking or demanding or using the leverage of aid to require a different, better government?
Oh, I would agree that it is. You know, the violence and intimidation out there has been extraordinary. We witnessed this firsthand in the run-up to the 2000 parliamentary elections. But I would suggest that the caller distinguish between the government and the people. We want to help the people of Zimbabwe. We don't want them to starve. So food security and those kinds of things would clearly continue, but there is a selective sanctions in place now that was put in place by President Bush in late February that are being carried out. A message needs to be delivered. You know, the caller is right about the manipulation of the colonial period and the legacy and the problems, but I also would suggest to you, I think the young African leaders, you know, if you come to Zimbabwe and talk to the younger folks in working in education and NGOs, the entrepreneurs, they want to move past that. They want the same kinds of things you and I do.
Mm-hmm.
And here in a country with 90% literacy,
they ought to have it.
The vote's averted at the end of the day,
mm-hmm.
and so you know, they deserve better governments.
Martin Meredith, what's your view on that point? Is this new willingness to be aggressive in requiring better government a kind of patronization of Africans on the part of the West, or is this solidarity with African people?
No, I don't think it's patronizing at all, although it might be perceived as that. Is that essentially kind of a comeback to the point that I made right at the very beginning, but that there is this great democratic instinct in Africa amongst its people,
mm-hmm.
That they want their voices heard. They want democracy. They want things to be resolved in an orderly fashion. The problem with Africa is that over a very long period, a period really now lasting for 40 years, has been the record of African leadership over that period has been, on the whole, abysmal. And the West has been often complicit in the level of bad governments and trashing of human rights and all the rest of it that has gone on because people like Mobutu, basically, were our sons of bitches, if you like.
Yeah.
But now the West no longer sees the need to underwrite bad government in the way that it used to do.
So maybe that support's beginning to change.
Yes, and that's for the benefit of the African people. I mean, I think that the record of Western aid, if you like, over a 20-30 year period is pretty mixed. Much of it's wasted, much of it's been used by corrupt leaders to line their own pockets.
Another 20-30 years of aid like that, and we'll have a real hell on earth.
Let me just say, Thomas and Bester McDonald, again, in the case of Zimbabwe, and I would suggest to you these countries now in terms of the United States, Zimbabwe, we are funding HIV/AIDS, more than 13 voluntary counseling testing centers nationwide, testing and counseling for people who have AIDS, who believe they do, and in a democracy program. The State University of New York at Albany has a major democracy project with the parliament where you had 57 opposition elected. So it's not waste and abuse there. None of the money goes directly to the government. It goes to NGOs and those that are doing things that we think are appropriate in the bilateral relationship and assisting to the citizens of Zimbabwe.
Ambassador McDonald, let me get one more call in here. Steve is on the line. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
Yes, Scott. Good evening. Great
Hi.
Show.
Thank you.
First, I just wanted to point out that this whole issue of good governance and conditioning aid to Africa has really been going on since 1991, when all the donors got together and conditioned aid to the Moi regime in Kenya and got him to legalize the opposition parties. And there are other clear examples like Malawi, etc.
So it's not brand new, but the volume has been upped to where we now hear it, Steve.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting to hear, Bush talk about it at the Monterey Summit was a step forward because even though it started under his father's watch, it hasn't become a high-profile issue.
Steve, take us to your bottom line. Our time's running down.
Yeah. Most of the countries in Africa achieved independence with democratic constitutions, and they quickly reverted to authoritarianism. They had this notion of one-party democracy in Africa, which turned into a farce. But I would argue that it had a seed of truth, which is that Africa needs not just democracy in our American adversarial sense, but they need development and they need national unity. And really what the countries like Zimbabwe, I would argue, need is a less adversarial model of democracy, not the U.S. model of two parties and winner-take-all, not the British Westminster model.
Steve, we got it, and I'm going to have to leave it there because our time is going. I want to just get a quick response from each of our guests. Tom McDonald, is there a different kind of democracy that Africa needs? In a few seconds, if you could.
Absolutely. I mean, there are certain fundamental principles, voting, regular elections, human rights protection, and so on, good governance we talked about. That's a basic model. They can find their own nuances to it.
And Martin Meredith, what do you say? Is this giving Africa its own head, or is this giving Africans less than they deserve?
I don't think there's kind of one model of democracy that Africa needs to follow. And there are all varieties of democracy, but basically, as what the ambassador said, that there are basic fundamental principles that needed to be observed if they're going to be democracy and good governance. And on the whole, most African states don't abide by them.
Martin Meredith, author of Our Votes, Our Guns, Robert Mugabe and the Tragedy of Zimbabwe, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Ambassador Tom McDonald, now at the Washington law firm of Arter and Haddon, thank you very much for being with us.
Tom, it was great to be with all of you.
Jack Beatty, it feels like the conversation is turning some kind of corner here, though it may be a long, slow turn.
Yeah, and perhaps a turn where, as one of our guests said, we can actually use leverage the leverage of aid to make a better life for Africans. That's much to be deserved. You know, we've seen this pattern before. Men who make revolution are just very reluctant to give up power. Sukarno in Indonesia, in India, the Congress Party ruled for nearly 50 years after independence. It's a tough thing. They make the revolution, they bleed for it, they kill for it, and then they're just very reluctant to give over power.
And yet there comes a time, sometime, when it's time to turn it over. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you very much.
To learn more about Robert Mugabe and the recent elections in Zimbabwe, check out our website. The address is onpoint.org. Thomas Mapfuno provided the soundtrack for the independence movement that brought Robert Mugabe to power. We spoke to the musician known as the Lion of Zimbabwe back in February. At the time, he expressed skepticism that Mugabe would be removed from office with the then upcoming election. In the 1970s, Mapfumo's music spurred a revolution itself. Two decades later, Rhodesia is now Zimbabwe. Robert Mugabe is still in power. But much of the poverty and governmental oppression the revolutionaries fought to change still exists. Now, we're going to listen to some of Thomas Mapfumo's words from that evening as he reflected on Robert Mugabe and what he sees as the need to continue the struggle for freedom in Zimbabwe.
I wasn't, a supporter of Robert Mugabe as such. I was supporting the struggle. The people who were actually oppressed and the people who were struggling. My music, played a very, very important role during the struggle. And I was jailed for this type of music. I wasn't actually worried about myself going to detention for this type of music because I was one of the oppressed, and I thought my music could play a very, very important role by, helping to liberate the country.
Mm-hmm.
I was expecting a lot of, changes to happen in that country, expecting our people to live a good life after independence. But that was not to be at all. The situation just got worse and worse. Today, people are still suffering. It's like in the old days when people were fighting for their freedom. And today, they are doing the same thing. The struggle is not over. They are still struggling. They have to fight another war. When you are a freedom fighter, really, you don't get tired. You keep on fighting until, you get, the real thing, the real freedom that, you would have, fought for. If you look at, the whole situation, it's like, people have to unite again, like before, and actually do away with this evil system which is there today. There is no difference between Rhodesia and Zimbabwe.
The words and music of Thomas Mapfuno from an interview we did with a Zimbabwean musician last month. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.